talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, it's 1066 and all that as we find out about the life, wars and legacy of William the Conqueror and debate how he changed England and indeed Ireland forever. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And if you want to listen back to this or to any of our older shows, just go to the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, our website newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. Tonight's show is on the life, death and enduring legacy of one of the most pivotal figures of medieval Europe, William the Conqueror. Born in Normandy, France, the illegitimate son of Duke Robert I, William rose to become Duke of Normandy and later the King of England. His ascension to the English throne followed the decisive Battle of Hastings in 1066, a victory that forever changed the landscape of England. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore how William's conquests and reforms laid the groundwork for modern English governance and legal systems, as we uncover the life of a ruler whose impact resonates through the annals of history. And to help me do all of this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor George Carnett is Professor of Medieval History at St. Hugh's College, the University of Oxford. His books include Conquered England, Kingship, Succession and Tenure, and he's just published the first volume of a history of the history of the Norman Conquest from the late 11th century to the beginning of the 17th, The Norman Conquest in English History, Volume 1, A Broken Chain. Professor Virginia Davis is Professor of Medieval History at Queen Mary University of London and is an expert on the Norman Conquest and on women and gender in late medieval England. Professor Hugh M. Thomas is Professor of History at the University of Miami and is an expert on medieval England. And his books include The English and the Normans, Ethnic Hostility, Assimilation and Identity After the Norman Conquest, and The Norman Conquest, England After William the Conqueror. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Professor Sean Duffy, Professor of Medieval Irish and Insular History at Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Mark Morris, the author of The Norman Conquest. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And George, I might just start with you and just go straight into it. To what extent was the victory of William the Conqueror in 1066 the start of a massive regime change in England?
It very much was, yes. He pretends, or rather his advisers pretend, that it's business as usual, that they're carrying on with the old regime. But in doing so, they utterly transform the old regime. I should think that there was a bigger turnover, for instance, in landholding in the 20 years after the conquest as in, say, Russia after 1917. There was total expropriation of most Englishmen in the wake of the conquest. Everybody held land on quite new terms, which were presented as existing traditional terms, but were not.
And I'm kind of a bit confused about how William ended up taking over, because it all seems to go back to Edward the Confessor, King Edward the Confessor, who died without a child. And then there was all these different disputes over who was going to take over. And you had Harold Godwin's son taking over. But then you also had this Duke of Normandy. And I'm just wondering, how did William, as the illegitimate son of the Duke in Normandy, end up first of all coming to dominance and power there and then asserting this claim to the throne in England?
Well, it doesn't matter that he's illegitimate in Normandy. Illegitimacy is really a later concept, not much later. By the 12th century, it did matter that your parents had been married. But in the 11th century, it didn't. He became Duke of Normandy because his father orchestrated his succession as Duke normal Norman fashion, which is to say, getting all of the nobility together and making them swear allegiance to his son. So there wasn't much of a problem about his becoming Duke, even though he was only a child. There followed a great deal of disorder in the duchy during his minority. But interestingly, all of that was focused on him. So, for instance, the procurator of the ducal household was murdered in the boy's bedroom. His teacher was murdered. His guardian was murdered, but he survived. The question of why he became King of England, of course, has been hotly contested ever since. And in my view, he had no claim to become King of England. The claim, which is rehearsed by many historians, has been rehearsed by them since the 1070s, and it still is being rehearsed by historians, is a post-conquest Norman fabrication for which there is absolutely no English evidence.
Yeah, Virginia, it is a fascinating story because I think as we're hearing from George, there are all these claims afterwards and assertions afterwards saying that Edward the Confessor promised the throne to William and that therefore it was legitimate, and there's all of these claims after the fact. But when you tease through all of them, you know, how strong is the claim and how strong are the claims of other people?
Well, I think it's certainly possible that there may have been some sort of promise made in the early 1050s when the very powerful Godwin family, who dominated the Anglo-Saxon aristocracy, when they were actually momentarily out of favour. But at that stage, there are certainly, as George says, no real contemporary evidence that such a promise was made. And William essentially became King of England because he won. He seized the opportunity of Harold Godwinson's seizure of the English throne to opportunistically invade. And it really was his victory at Hastings and his subsequent success in putting down rebellions that, in fact, gave him the role of King of England.
So in a sense, was it the fact that you could assert your claim and prove your claim by force of arms? That was pretty much what really mattered in the end.
Yes. And in the absence of any serious leader or contender within England, once Harold had been killed at Hastings.
So, Hugh, when you weigh up all the different things, ultimately, is that really all it came down to? Who had the bigger army? Who was the better general? Rather than what promises were supposedly made on different deathbeds or in at different stages of the career of Edward the Confessor?
Yes, I think that's correct. I think part of what had happened is that earlier, the West Saxon dynasty, which became the ruling House of England, had a very strong history of succession from generation to generation, sometimes infighting and so forth. But that had been undermined by the Danish takeover in the early 11th century, which showed that kings with essentially no claim to England could take control. And after Canute, who was the Danish king who solidified that control, after he died, there was fighting among his sons. After they died, there was a return to Edward the Confessor from the West Saxon dynasty. So that dynasty's legitimacy still mattered somewhat, but it was clear at this point that England could be taken by force, internally by Harold Godwinson, or externally by Harald Hardrada, King of Norway, who also made a try, or ultimately successfully by Duke William. Strikingly, there was a claimant from the West Saxon family, but he was young and his branch of the family had been in exile for generations. He had no power base. So Harold Godwinson was originally able to seize the throne, and then William took it away from him.
And George, it really is one of those dates that resonates in English history, the year 1066. It's every school child knows about the Battle of Hastings over in England. It just is one of those iconic moments. And I know I understand why it's so pivotal in terms of the reforms that happened, the changes that came with it. But was it seen as such a hugely significant moment at the time, this Battle of Hastings?
Well, certainly the conquest was seen as so significant, yes, because of the way in which the country is transformed. I've already mentioned the expropriation of the existing English aristocracy, but another and very visible way in which it's transformed, of course, is that every major church was demolished within, let's say, half a century and completely rebuilt, so that the new regime reconstruct England in a physical sense. Someone who had departed from England in 1066 or just before 1066 and returned in, let's say, 1100, 1120, would have found the place literally unrecognizable. All of the new church buildings were built in a completely different style. And of course, the country was studded with castles, which had not really existed before the conquest. These are Norman or continental style fortifications.
And Virginia, why did he win the Battle of Hastings? You know, I've read that his cavalry was hugely significant, that he also was a master of these feigned retreats that were able to catch the Anglo-Saxons out. You also have, I think, some pivotal mistakes that Harold made in the course of the battle that played into William's hand, that William just seemed to have the better military experience, the better tactics, and he seemed to have the better troops as well.
I think that doesn't really do justice to Harold Godwinson as a military leader. What I think drastically undermined his position was the fact that only a few weeks before the Battle of Hastings, he had marched his army north to defeat a Scandinavian invasion. And immediately upon doing this, he got news that William had landed in the south of England and was ravaging the territories there in a deliberate attempt to provoke a pitched battle. So he had to march his army down again. And he had lost men. He'd lost some men at the battle at Stamford Bridge. But in fact, I think essentially he was fighting with an army that was tired. And I think the battle might have gone very differently if, in fact, William had arrived earlier in the summer when Harold was with his troops in the south of England waiting for him.
And Virginia, was that a mistake then, a tactical error by Harold, that he shouldn't have rushed in and given William the battle that he was looking for, that he should have waited for reinforcements and he should have just allowed his army to regroup and recover from their exhaustion and then draw out William?
I think William was, as I say, provoking a battle. And in order to do so, we have scenes, and you can see them on the Bayeux Tapestry, of women and children fleeing as Norman soldiers put their properties to burn. So I think Harold couldn't really stand by and let the southern part of the country, particularly Wessex, which was the area of which he had previously been Earl, let that be attacked in this way.
And the popular imagery, Harold gets shot, killed with an arrow through his eye. Now, there's different debates and disputes about that, but that becomes part of the iconography of the battle as well. And is William hailed as the conqueror pretty much straight after that?
Well, he marches up towards London with a somewhat circuitous route. And no, he's not, because the earls, in fact, there is a brief suggestion among the surviving earls that the young Edgar Atheling, successor of Edward the Confessor's line, might be a leader. But as was said earlier, he was only a young boy. And so in the end, the nobles agreed to accept William for the moment. However, you're absolutely right that we all think of 1066 as being a pivotal date. But actually, between 1066 and the early 1070s, William faced a whole spate of rebellions. And I think he couldn't really feel he had the entire country under his control until the early 1070s. So things could have all gone very differently in 1069, 1068, any of those years.
And Virginia, what do you make of him in terms of his personality? That there are reports that he was charismatic, there are reports that he was this, you know, much admired leader. How much of, again, of that is mythology, and how much of that do we have evidence for?
Clearly, some of those who write about him during his reign and in the immediate aftermath are painting a rosy picture of his personality, of his achievements. But actually, most of that is, in fact, borne out by the evidence. He's a physically big man. He is strong. He is a very successful military leader. And we can see that both in his efforts in Normandy to defend his dukedom against external threats. So I think he is charismatic. People do follow him. But he knows how to use his dukely and kingly power effectively. So he can, for example, behave. There are displays of kingly anger, which are actually at least partly performative to demonstrate his power. I think he is a very charismatic leader indeed.
Very interesting. And Hugh, you also have, split loyalties, or, you know, split responsibilities for him, because he can't afford to spend all his time in England. And he's also back in France and back in Normandy. And for example, the year 1074, he spends the whole year there. So he's having to keep his eye on other parts of his reign as well.
I think those 5 years that Virginia mentioned, along with the Battle of Hastings itself, are crucial in that he was remarkably quickly, 5 years may not have seemed quickly at the time, but he was remarkably quickly able to basically destroy resistance and to set in motion the remarkable replacement of the Anglo-Saxon aristocracy that George referred to. And so once that had been accomplished, yes, he and his successors faced the problem of trying to keep control of things on both sides of the channel, but he was able to go back to Normandy, and he was able to rely on a loyal following that he had built up in his earlier wars in Normandy, and that he had increased by giving so much English land to them, that with some exceptions, he had a nobility that was willing to support him independently, or on their own, I should say, as well as when he was with them.
And you also have in that period, you know, what's called the harrying of the north, where you really do see his military prowess. You really do see his strengths as a military leader.
Yes. Now, one thing it should be stressed is that this kind of destruction of the countryside was a fairly common part of war in this time. But in the north, he seems to have taken it to unusual extremes, thereby crushing resistance, depriving his enemies, the native aristocracy in the north, of their economic means of subsistence, and so devastating the area in the short term, but crushing his opposition by some pretty relentless campaigning.
And George, how significant were the attempts to overthrow William the Conqueror then, up until his death in 1087? We've heard about some of the challenges that he faced, and it definitely seems that certainly in that first part, things were not entirely clear-cut for him.
No, they weren't. There was, as the others have said, there was considerable resistance in a succession of native rebellions, but the problem was that the English never really got their act together. Though there is a report of Edgar Atheling, who's already been referred to, having been consecrated as king in York in 1068, so that would have been the most serious threat from William's point of view, and may why he was so very brutal in his treatment of the North in 1069, because he saw it as potentially a very serious threat to his position. But after 1072, there aren't really any significant native English attempts to dislodge him. There's a big rebellion in 1075, but that is, in effect, led by Normans who are very disaffected. They don't think that they've got enough out of the conquest and take grave exception. But William successfully dealt with that problem too.
Okay, well, tonight we are talking about William the Conqueror and the Norman Conquest. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Professor Sean Duffy and Dr. Mark Morris about what this all meant for Wales, for Scotland, and indeed for Ireland. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history and we're talking about the life and legacy of William the Conqueror. And for this section, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Sean Duffy, Professor of Medieval Irish and Insular History at Trinity College Dublin, and an expert on the history of medieval Ireland, including Irish relations with England, Scotland and Wales, as well as the history and archaeology of medieval Dublin. And I'm also joined by Dr. Mark Morris, an historian and broadcaster and an expert on the Middle Ages, and he's the author of The Norman Conquest. Well, you're both very welcome. And Sean, maybe let's talk about the Norman Conquest and let's talk about Ireland. What did the victory of William the Conqueror at Hastings mean for Ireland? And what did it mean for Scotland? What did it mean for Wales?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, Patrick, because we always think of the Norman Conquest of England. But the fact is the Normans were no great respecters of borders. So when William the Conqueror arrived onto the island of Britain, my sense is that it was irrelevant to him that the Welsh conceived of themselves as a separate nation to the English, or that Scotland was a separate kingdom. And so within a comparatively short time, we see the Normans expanding beyond the borders of England into Wales and conquered quite a bit. In fact, they conquered the most southwesterly tip of Wales, the part of Wales closest to Ireland, what's nowadays Pembrokeshire. And likewise, they headed straight into Gwynedd in northwest Wales and indeed to Anglesey and established a presence there. It's a very interesting fact that the way in Ireland in the Middle Ages, we have a continuous set of annals for every year. And the Welsh had an annal tradition. And if you look at the contemporary Welsh annals for the decades immediately after 1066, they have more references to events in Ireland and things to do with the Irish Sea region than they have mentions of the Normans. It's about two decades. The Normans are on the island of Britain for about 20 years before the Welsh really begin to take notice of what it is they're doing, and they start to become at the centre of their attention. That's because Wales traditionally had very close connections with Ireland. So they report events that occur there and connections between us and them. The Norman involvement with Scotland was on a slightly greater level than with Wales, because Wales at that time was very like the way Ireland was governed. Ireland was divided into a whole series of a half dozen or more provinces. So whilst there was a theoretical high king of the whole island, in reality, if you engaged with Ireland, you had to engage on a one-to-one basis with individual province kings. Scotland, the system was, funnily enough, paralleled that in England in that it was a national kingdom. So when the Normans came to deal with Scotland, they had to deal with a single king. And so you have international relations at that royal level between them. But again, the Normans being no respecters of boundaries, they fairly rapidly turned their attention to Scotland, and we see involvement. I mean, Newcastle on Tyne exists to this day, but it was established as part of this Norman attempt to look north, to protect their northern frontiers. The boundary between England and Scotland at that time was still fluid. It hadn't been fixed where it currently is. So it was still a matter for debate. So just where Norman power would end and Scottish power begin was, well, and remains for generations, a matter for debate. So it was inevitable that there would be conflict and there would be intrusion by the Normans beyond the borders of England into both Wales and Scotland in the decades following 1066.
And we, of course, date the Norman invasion to 1169, and we talk about that as this pivotal moment in our history, in our country. How useful is it to describe that as the Norman invasion? And I suppose, why did it take them so long?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an interesting... There are two separate questions there, Patrick. One of those is about this: the fact that we refer to these people as Normans. I mean, you are an authority on 18th and 19th century Ireland. So if you look at, say, books written in the 50 years up to about 1800... Irish history books, and the books written between about 1800 and 1850. During the course of that, Irish historians stopped referring to what had happened in Ireland from 1169 onwards as the English invasion, and they began to refer to it as the Norman invasion. And it's interesting to speculate as to why that might have been. I mean, one of the explanations that has been put forward for this, the Irish insistence on referring to 1169 as a Norman conquest, is actually to do with the success of Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. I don't know when Ivanhoe was published. Was it 1816 or something like that?
Yeah, around then, yeah.
He kind of invented the cult of the Normans. The Normans became, if our listeners would pardon us, became sexy in the early 19th century. And so there was a tendency to talk about Normans where previously people might have talked about English. But it's also the case that there's a guy you know something about by the name of Daniel O'Connell. You know, when he used to lambast English involvement in Ireland, he would talk about 700 years of oppression at the hands of the English. So there was something to be said for softening the impact of that nationalist claim by suggesting that actually for the first 300 or 400 years, they weren't English. These were these beautiful French-speaking people, these Normans, who became more Irish than the Irish themselves. And so there was a kind of a tactic. I mean, one of the most important books on this subject, still a really valuable work written about 100 years ago by a man called Goddard Orpen, is called Ireland Under the Normans. But I think if Orpen had been writing a century earlier, he would have called it Ireland Under the English. And Orpen was a phenomenal historian, but he was also a soft unionist, opposed to the home rule notion in Ireland. And so I think it sort of suited his purpose to conceive of medieval Ireland as not the Irish as not having been victims of an English conquest, but as having partaken in this great experiment of the Normanization, the Frenchification of northwestern Europe. So, you know, so we shouldn't, politics comes into, as you know, into all history writing, and we're all prisoners of our own, you know, political baggage that we have. And these are things that we have to give some consideration to when we're writing about events, even as remote as events that happened 850 years ago now.
Mark, you've written extensively on the Norman conquest. You've also written a biography of William the Conqueror, William the First, a part of the Penguin Monarch series. And when researching that, what did you feel you got a new insight into the personality and character of William the Conqueror?
I think in the conclusion to that, I tried to sort of pay particular attention to what contemporaries said about him rather than what people have said about him in the nigh on 1,000 years after his death. I think one of the things that struck me when I was trying to sum him up was his piety, which I think was exceptional. It's always normal for medievalists when they're talking about people in the medieval period to talk about them as conventionally pious. But William does seem to have been particularly religious, even by contemporary standards. It's quite noticeable that at a time when, in Normandy in particular, but also in Anglo-Saxon England, the powerful men in general, seem to have multiple marriages and lots of illegitimate children. No one ever makes that accusation against William himself. William himself was a product of a sort of how should we say, less than formal or less formal than the church would have liked liaison. And he's very good friends. His spiritual tutor was Lanfranc, who later becomes Archbishop of Canterbury. He was originally Abbot of Bec in Normandy. And this seems to sort of permeate his behavior as king. And so, that, I mean, that was my one takeaway, is that I think he was a man who felt that kind of God was on his side and was being steered by God. And remember, you're only, by the time he dies in 1087, you're only less than a decade away from the launching of the First Crusade, in which Normans in particular were prominent. So he's you can see where this mindset comes from, but it seems to have been pioneeringly early in his case.
And he seems to have been very clever at the way he was able to turn what, you know, is described as this messy land grab into a legal transfer of land and power and wealth and authority.
Again, I don't know how much of that is down to him. I mean, I think if you look at what contemporaries said about him, people said he was a man of extraordinary power and wisdom. And that's sort of said in his obituary in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And what he's able to do, because he is extremely powerful, just by virtue of, you know, come down to brass tacks, violence, that his skill as a general and the violence that he can marshal amongst the Norman elite. He's in charge of probably the most sophisticated state in Europe, possibly excepting the Ottonian Empire, i.e. Anglo-Saxon England. And the thing you're talking about there, Doomsday Book, in terms of, you know, surveying the whole kingdom and trying to sort out the mess in terms of landowning that his land grab has created, that's a consequence of having taken over a very powerful state. So it's the two things together, really, that enable him to launch the Doomsday Inquiry in 1085.
And how do you think he was viewed in his lifetime, both within England and further afield on the continent? For some, he was accepted, but for others, they never accepted the conquest.
Well, within England, they were ultimately made to accept the conquest. I mean, you're right in that the conquest, there were rebellions against William's rule for the first 4 or 5 years of his reign, not just in the north of England, which is the one that tends to get the most written about it, but across the whole country, in the southwest, in the West Midlands, in the east. After 1070, 1071, particularly after the harrying of the north, which is one of the most controversial and shocking episodes in William's reign, there are no more native rebellions. And, you know, of course, I think the study that was done by this about 20, 25 years ago by Elizabeth Van Hoot, looking at William, not just what people said about him in Normandy and in England, but across the whole of Europe, concluded that in the Frankish-speaking world, i.e. not just Normandy, but other parts of modern France, they saw it as a triumph of Frankish arms. And they sort of, if not praised him to the skies, kind of thought he was generally a good thing. It's more difficult to discern what people thought about him in England because there wasn't much said about him until a generation or so later. The best source for him is the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which I've already mentioned, which acknowledged his power and wisdom, but also went on to list the suffering he caused. He's criticized as being a bloodthirsty warrior, and conquest is seen as being illegitimate and all about brute force. So, you know, it's a mixed bag of reviews he gets.
And as you show, he was crowned on Christmas Day in 1066, and a date that was chosen for all of the symbolism and meaning. But various things went wrong, and that was seen as portents for those who were watching.
Yes, well, I mean, Christmas Day is an obvious one to focus on, given that it took him several weeks to subdue just the southeast after the Battle of Hastings. So he's only got, you know, 8 or 9 weeks after Hastings to make his way to London, which continued to resist. And Christmas Day is a good day for rulers to be crowned. Charlemagne had been crowned on Christmas Day 800 as emperor. So it's a nice, significant, obviously, religious feast to go for. Yes, we are told, I mean, the descriptions of what happened at his coronation are written by Norman sources. So we have to sort of try and see through the propaganda. But clearly something went very, very wrong. The source we've got is William of Poitiers, William's contemporary biographer, who says, that he says that it's when the English shouted out their acclaim for the new king, the guards outside panicked and thought it was some sort of riot inside the church and started setting fire to the surrounding buildings, which doesn't make any sense whichever way you read it. But clearly there was the violence between the Normans and the people of Westminster while the ceremony was going on. And it caused people to panic and rush out of the church. So the only people who finished the coronation were William himself and the officiating clergy.
And Sean, finally then, do you think that 1066 and the Battle of Hastings, did it change the relationship between Ireland and the Irish and the English?
Oh, it did, undoubtedly, Patrick. I mean, the relationship between the Irish and the English was obviously of very long standing prior to 1066. And it was almost, without exception, insofar as we can tell, a friendly relationship. There were one or two very minor incidents of what seemed to be political conflict between the two, but it was otherwise a perfectly amicable relationship. And there was nothing, almost without exception, there was nothing remotely imperialistic about English attitudes to Ireland. They didn't believe that they were superior to the Irish, and they didn't believe that Ireland belonged to them. After 1066, that changes. It changes really rapidly. In fact, Mark was talking about the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. I think it's the Peterborough version of it that says in its obituary notice of William the Conqueror that had he lived for another 2 years, he would have conquered Ireland, and he'd have conquered it without any weapons, it says. Whatever that means, I don't know. But he was certainly, we know, we have contemporary evidence for his knowledge of Irish affairs, his involvement with Ireland.
Well, my thanks to Professor Sean Duffy, Professor of Medieval Irish and Insular History at Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Mark Morris, author of The Norman Conquest and that biography, William the First, for joining me. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'll be rejoined by my panel as we explore the legacy of the Norman Conquest and find out what happened when William died in 1087. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and we are talking about the life and legacy of William the Conqueror and the Norman Conquest. And I'm delighted to be rejoined by our panel of experts, Professor George Garnett, Professor of Medieval History at St. Hugh's College, the University of Oxford, Professor Virginia Davis, Professor of Medieval History at Queen Mary University of London, and Professor Hugh M. Thomas, Professor of History at the University of Miami. George, can we talk then about the legacy of the Norman Conquest? Because it did bring in all of these transformational changes, as we've been talking about. It did set in motion so much that, you know, I suppose defined England for the next few centuries. So even in terms of the language, we see significant changes.
Yes, we do. In the late 11th, 12th centuries, England was a trilingual society in that the English were obviously still speaking English. The French were speaking French, and the church and the governmental administration work in Latin. So if you think about Doomsday Book being compiled in 1086, that must be an operation which involves people translating between three different languages. Modern English is very, very different from Old English, which is rather more like German. But modern English only emerges over centuries. It's really only beginning to appear in the 13th century.
And why did William order the commissioning of the Doomsday Book? Was it simply a matter of taxation that he wanted to know how much land there was and how much money that he could get for everything in terms of taxation? Or was it just a desire to bring everything together systematically in terms of the administration and to make things more efficient?
It's, in effect, a colossal charter recording the end of that process of redistribution of land, and it enables the royal administration to exploit those who hold direct from the king now very effectively, because it records exactly how much they hold in each shire. Doomsday Book isn't really interested in lower levels of the tenurial hierarchy. It's interested in the really wealthy, important people, whether they are laymen or clerics. So it's misleading, I think, to say that it's mainly about tax. It's about the exploitation of the king's powers as ultimate landlord. And it is, so far as we can see, pretty much an unprecedented operation. The amazing thing about it is plans are laid and the process is started at Christmas 1085, and the whole thing is finished by the 1st of August 1086. Now, it's very difficult to imagine any modern government managing that sort of operation in that time frame.
And Virginia, it's also interesting that William himself doesn't seem to have been able to speak English. So it was incredibly difficult for him, or it required extra help from all his people around him. When you were dealing with the three languages that George has talked about there, you needed someone for the English, you needed someone then for the Latin, and then he would have had the French himself.
Yes, and I think, but England was, certainly the aristocracy in England were accustomed to operating in several languages, because we think of Old English, of Anglo-Saxon. But if you, at the court of Edward the Confessor, Edward had been brought up in as an exile in Normandy. He had a substantial number of French and Norman friends and compatriots at the court. So there was already a French overtone. There, the Scandinavian kings of England, obviously, were also multilingual. So actually, it was a challenge. And certainly, if you were good at languages, you had a bright future, I would think, in the late 11th century. But it was not unprecedented. So there would have been men at court who could speak French and English and Latin.
And was there then that clear divide between the aristocracy, the lords, and the regular people then, because one are speaking French and the others are speaking English?
Yes, and I think that's left its mark on the language that we have today. Just for example, the thinking about words for food, the peasants who were in the fields continued to call the animals by the names they were accustomed to in English. When that food arrived on the Lord's table, it was being called by the words the French were accustomed to. So, for example, we have cows in the fields, but we have beef from the French bœuf on the table.
So there's a very clear example of how the French word, how the aristocracy would have understood it, is becomes part of our English language then. And so you do see these significant changes then. And were these resented, I wonder? Was there an us versus them divide? Or like, to what extent? And maybe, Hugh, I might bring you in on that, because, you know, you wrote about the English and the Normans and your subtitle was Ethnic Hostility, Assimilation and Identity. And they are really those challenges in those 200 years afterwards, to what extent you find the people merging and to what extent there is that hostility.
I think there's a great deal of hostility early on. I would say that the assimilation happens surprisingly fast, and I'm actually one of the more pessimistic people in terms of the speed with which it happens. But I would say within a little more than a century, there's not much distinction between the two peoples as far as we can tell. And that contemporaries themselves remark that this is no longer a matter of concern. So, yes, I think there is resentment, but partly because William had crushed military resistance so quickly, there's no cycle of violence that creates a built-in long-term hostility. And even though, yes, there's very much a class divide, you have sort of the people at the bottom end of the landowning class who can merge pretty easily with the people at the top end of the peasant class. So you have in towns, the English elites mingled with the new French immigrants. So there were places where that assimilation could begin. As time went on, more and more French became bilingual. And French as an important literary language remained for centuries. But as time went on, the linguistic divide on a day-to-day basis within a few generations would probably have been erased.
And Hugh, what happened then after the death of William the Conqueror in 1087? Because he seems to have divided his territories, which seems to have been standard practice among the Normans at the time. But there was then tensions between them and later conflict.
Yes. Being more precise, it seems there was a distinction made between inherited land and acquired land. And there's also flexibility. But at the time of William's death, he and his eldest son, Robert Curthose, were very much on the outs. William felt that he had to give the inheritance, Normandy, to Robert, but he was able to give the acquisition to his younger son, William Rufus, and then give some money to his third son, Henry. And Robert Curthose, as you may imagine, was not too content with this. And there was fighting between the brothers. Eventually, it was settled between Robert and William by Robert going off on the First Crusade. William died in a hunting accident. Henry took over, and then there was fighting between Henry and Robert, which was eventually settled by Henry capturing Robert and putting him in prison for the rest of his life.
Okay, so not happy siblings, and once again, land, power, and money getting in the way of all of these relationships. George, I'm fascinated by the idea of how William was perceived and viewed then in the centuries after his death, and how the story was told. Was he a hero who had instituted all of these great changes, or was he a villain who had conquered England and who had been involved in this dramatic overthrow? You know, was he someone who was remembered as a conqueror and invader and remembered for his harsh policies, or viewed as someone who had brought in all of these legal and administrative innovations, who had unified England?
All of those things. You can read all of those views over the centuries which follow. But I would say that the prevailing view amongst lawyers becomes that William may or may not have partly confirmed existing English laws and custom, but that those certainly were confirmed and indeed restored in Magna Carta in 1215 under King John. So the view which prevails through the centuries is that this was a blip. This becomes a blip in the continuity of English liberties and of English law. Now, I think that is completely to underestimate the extent of the transformation which actually happened. And the argument between those two views of the significance of the conquest really comes into focus in the late 16th and particularly the 17th century. And you could see the English Civil War as a battle over the Norman legacy, whether English liberties are going to be preserved against Stuart tyranny, which is following in the wake of William the Conqueror, or not. So that the Norman conquest comes back to the fore in subsequent constitutional conflicts in Britain.
And as you say, there is this dramatic change and transformation in England. There is all these physical changes in terms of the castles and the buildings, and there's changes to the way things are done with the feudal system. There's a centralization of power, that it is very much a different country after William than it was before.
That's correct, yes. I mean, England prior to the conquest had been probably the most efficiently run centralized governmental entity in Western Europe in the early Middle Ages. But after the conquest, and as a result of the conquest, it becomes unique in a second way, that all land depends upon the king, the tenure of all land. And that means that feudalism, if we can use that term in England, is very different from feudalism in, let's say, France, in that historians tend to think of feudalism in France as involving the the disintegration of royal authority. In England, it means the intensification of royal authority. And if we want to look for an explanation of why the United Kingdom is still so centralised, the place we have to look, really, I think, is the Norman Conquest.
Very good. Virginia, how would you see the legacy of William the Conqueror, and would you see it as a positive one or a negative one?
I think ultimately one would see it as a positive legacy. But I think one of the things which actually change in England is that England shifts from having an essentially Scandinavian orientation, because under the Danish kings, Canute in particular, England was very much, it was tied to Europe, but it was looking particularly towards the Scandinavian European countries. Once we've had the Norman Conquest, England is pulled, I think, more squarely into having a focus on links with France in particular.
And Hugh, do you think when you look at his different preoccupations, the acquired territories versus the home territories, what was the most important for him? Was it Normandy or was it England?
That would have been a hard decision, because Normandy, of course, was his homeland. It was his power base. It's where many of his soldiers came from. England was a larger and richer place, and so greatly increased his power, greatly increased his status, because he was now a king. It was one of the dilemmas for him and his successors, was how to maintain power in both, because they were both important. And later on, of course, you have with Henry II, you have the addition of other parts of France. So the question of England versus the continent is a very big one for some generations. And indirectly, that goes on, of course, until the Hundred Years' War. I think they were both very important to him, and that's why he spent time on both sides of the Channel, making sure his power was fixed there.
So, George, overall then, would you see the legacy of William the Conqueror in terms of the transformation, the reshaping, the restructuring of England? Would you ultimately see that as a good thing, or just as something that we need to understand in its context and how it happened?
Well, as Virginia has rightly said, if the conquest hadn't happened, England might well have looked much more like a Scandinavian country than it does. Certainly, England would not have been so centralised as it became. Now, whether you think that that's a good thing or not is up to you, really, I think. I don't think there's much point in going back and deciding what is a good thing and what's a bad thing. The point about doing history is to understand what actually happened and why.
Well, I think that's an excellent note on which to end our discussion of William the Conqueror and the Norman Conquest. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor George Garnett, Professor of Medieval History at St. Hugh's College, the University of Oxford. His new book is The Norman Conquest in English History, Volume 1, A Broken Chain. Professor Virginia Davis, Professor of Medieval History at Queen Mary University of London. Professor Hugh M. Thomas, Professor of History at the University of Miami. And we also were joined by Dr. Mark Morris, the author of The Norman Conquest, and Professor Sean Duffy, Professor of Medieval Irish and Insular History at Trinity College Dublin. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, to Hannah Flam on research, and to Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.